I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Treatment instead of jail time for some drug offenders, and changes in how police are disciplined. No income tax cuts, but $37 million in tax breaks for aerospace giant Northrop Grumman. These were among the many last-minute votes by the General Assembly before the clock struck midnight. We look back at the session and examine which proposals made it to Governor Larry Hogan's desk and what happened once they arrived. WIPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay brings us the latest from Annapolis. Plus, Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog and Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green offer their reflections on the testy relationship between the very popular Republican governor and the legislature dominated by Democrats. On Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you could join us today. Legislators in Annapolis were negotiating right up to the midnight deadline last night, and as always, some bills failed to reach a vote before the General Assembly adjourned. For instance, a widely supported plan to reduce income taxes stalled over whether the tax relief should extend to Marylanders with high incomes. Governor Larry Hogan had harsh words for the legislature last night. Here's audio from the Baltimore Sun.
Overall, it was a good session. We're pretty pleased, but tonight was a little disappointing. And I got to tell you, this morning, all of you and all of us thought that we were this close on real, meaningful tax relief. And unfortunately, the Speaker of the House and the Senate President dropped the ball and failed to get it done.
Hogan said he was pleased legislators were talking about cutting taxes rather than raising them. He said he was generally pleased with the legislative session, but he and Democratic legislators sparred during the 90 days on proposals that ranged from public transit to portable air conditioners. The sniping at times felt personal. In February, Senate President Mike Miller called out Governor Hogan over a Facebook post. The post criticized specific legislators for overriding a veto on extending voting rights to felons.
The chief executive, you know, on Facebook, you know, whatever, puts 29 names out there, the people who voted that way, their telephone numbers, their address, their email address. And so we've been subjected to the most vicious hate mail you can possibly imagine.
Less than a week later, Governor Hogan, speaking on the C4 show on WBAL, had this crack about Maryland's lawmakers.
So, you know, they come into town, it's like they're on spring break, they come here for a few weeks and they start breaking up the furniture and throwing beer bottles off the balcony and all kinds of crazy stuff. But luckily, in a few weeks, they're going to go home and we go back to running the state and making progress like we have been for the past year.
As the session wore on, legislators shot back that the governor and his administration were frequent no-shows at hearings, leaving lawmakers without the information they needed to make informed votes. Despite the tension, the budget passed easily and with praise from both parties. And in the hours before the midnight deadline, legislators found common ground on criminal justice reform and police accountability, among other matters. Later in the hour, Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog and Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green will help us make sense of what happened and what didn't. But first, WIPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay joined us to bring us the latest from Annapolis. Rachel, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with the legislature's failure to reach a deal on income tax breaks. I mean, initially, it seemed to have broad support. What happened?
Well, so this really broke down over a key difference between the Senate and the House versions that passed. The House passed income tax cuts for lower and middle income earners. The Senate wanted to add to that some tax cuts for small businesses and for some higher income earners, people earning more than $150,000 a year. And that was really not going to work for a lot of House members. That wasn't going to pass the House.
What was it? I mean, on philosophical basis or on the fact that it would cost too much? What did it come down to, the disagreement? Why was the Senate pushing for tax relief for more affluent taxpayers?
Well, so for the Senate, this actually came out of a report, an Augustine Commission report is what they call it, commission that they'd convened to study the tax policies in the state and see whether the state is business-friendly enough. And the Senate said Senate leadership said that this expanded income tax cut would help the state, following the recommendations of this commission, become more business friendly. And so they weren't going to back down from this because they thought it was really important in that respect. And the House, I'm not sure. I think it probably was a philosophical issue for a lot of people, but it's hard to know. I'm guessing there was a lot of differing reasons among the different legislators in the House, but there was definitely some opposition to cutting income tax rates for the highest earners specifically.
Now, when Mike Miller was talking about it, Senate President Miller was talking about it after midnight last night, he seemed to connect the issue of cutting income taxes to the issue of paid sick leave. That was also a proposal, and it also failed. First of all, tell us briefly what that proposal would have done.
Sure. So the sick leave bill would have required any businesses with at least 15 employees to provide 1 hour of paid leave for every 30 hours worked, under the version that was most likely to come out of the committee. It didn't end up actually making it out of the committee, but the version that was most likely to make it out of committee would have up to at least 5 days of paid leave per year. There was a lot of opposition from the business community, and actually the reason it looks like it failed to get out of committee was due to some opposition from business leaders in some members' districts. But there were a couple of legislators in both chambers floated the idea of making some sort of deal where if the Senate were to bring the paid sick leave bill to the floor and vote and pass it, that the House would consider the Senate's version of the income tax cuts. A lot of other legislators said that that's just not how they do things here in Annapolis. They don't want to link to bills in that way because they want to consider each measure on its own merits.
That's an interesting concept. I'm not sure I've ever heard purity of topic being a defining principle out of Annapolis.
Yeah, I'm guessing that there are a lot of people who feel the same way. But yeah, no, a lot of legislators did want to be able to have an actual debate on each measure individually. And I think honestly, a lot of Republican members and some Democrat members really were concerned about the impact the paid sick leave bill would have on the business community. And I was speaking with the Senate Minority Leader, J.B. Jennings, who said, you know, he's not opposed to paid sick leave, but he thinks that the bill as written has some flaws and that maybe next year they can bring it back with some changes that make it a little more business friendly.
That's WIPR State House reporter Rachel Bay here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about what made it through the General Assembly before it adjourned at midnight and what failed to make it through. One of the things, Rachel, that did make it through was the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which I gather, policing in general, how what kind of changes did the General Assembly make that citizens ought to know about?
Yeah, so to be clear, this changed a lot of measures within the existing Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, and it deals with a number of things. It deals with the LEOBR specifically. It deals with some the way discipline is handled. One of the more controversial components of that was the role civilians would play in disciplinary decisions. Ultimately, they decided in a compromise that each local jurisdiction would get to decide whether civilians can vote in administrative disciplinary proceedings for law enforcement officers. But there were some also provisions in that affected, you know, how that there was that very infamous 10-day waiting period that law enforcement officers had when facing disciplinary interrogation and questioning. And that was shortened to 5 days in the bill. There was also some measures regarding training standards and recruitment practices and protections for whistleblowers, all sorts of things in that bill.
They also passed a very sweeping package of criminal justice reforms, and I'm not going to ask you in the couple of minutes we have left to tell us everything that's in it, but what are you picking up that legislators consider the most important part of that package?
So there are maybe a few that things that are really key. There's some measures that make it easier for people to get parole if they're nonviolent offenders, if they've served a certain amount of time, and also to remain out on parole even if they fail, perhaps if they have a parole violation, they maybe have to serve.
Have we lost Rachel?
Rachel, hello,
Rachel. We lost you for a second. You were saying.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm in the state house, and the service is a little spotty. But yeah, the one of the key measures would make it easier for people to get parole and remain out on parole. It would also the bill also would allow drug offenders to seek treatment and get treatment as opposed to necessarily serving prison time for certain drug offenses or get drug treatment while serving time. And it eliminated certain mandatory minimum sentences. All of this, the idea being it would both reduce the prison population and reform some of these more tough-on-crime measures that came out of the 80s, but also would help the state save some money by reducing the prison population.
On that point about treatment for drug offenders who themselves are addicted, my impression now is that there are lots of people who want treatment and it's not always available. Did the legislature make more funding available for treatment so that there can be more treatment offered?
So the bill does provide allocate a small amount of funding basically to speed up the process in which people are referred to get treatment. So right now that's the biggest issue is that judges will recommend people for treatment, but they'll have to wait a few months before they actually are able to get into a program. But the idea behind the bill is this reinvestment concept. So you reduce the prison population, and then you save all this money, and the money gets reinvested into treatment programs. So obviously you have to kickstart that, but with a little seed money, effectively. But
essentially, most of the state money that would support treatment is to come from the savings of having fewer people in prison, so it doesn't show up right away.
In theory, although it is worth noting, so the bill when it came in was projected to have all of these savings, more than $200 million in savings, and as amended, it's not completely clear what those savings would look like. So it remains to be seen whether additional money might have to be allocated to cover some of those programs.
This justice reinvestment proposal came into the legislature with it's something that a couple dozen other states have already done, and it came into the legislature with a lot of bipartisan support. Why did it go down to the wire? Why were they voting on that the last day?
It actually, to some extent, it came down to those measures, those savings. So what happened was in the Senate, there were some changes that gave judges more discretion in determining sentences and determining parole-related issues. And the House kind of passed a different measure that didn't give judges that discretion. But as a result, the arguments were that discretion cut back on some of the savings because it kept people in prison a little longer. And of course, the leaders in the Senate were arguing that it's really about public safety and that giving judges that discretion to keep people who might be dangerous off the streets is an important component of the bill. So they came to a compromise on a lot of those measures.
Rachel, I appreciate your giving us these insights into the last-minute compromises and failures to compromise. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Rachel Bay is WIPR State House reporter. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog and Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green are here to share their thoughts on some of the session's more contentious bills and Governor Hogan's relationship with the legislature. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wipr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're looking back today at the General Assembly session that ended at midnight last night. I'm joined now by Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green. Welcome back.
Thanks, Sheila.
And Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog. Welcome
Hi,
back.
Sheila.
One thing I didn't get to with Rachel was an idea that Mike Miller, the president of the Senate, raised last night when he was speaking about the failure to pass an income tax cut and the failure to pass legislation requiring businesses with 15 or more employees to offer paid sick leave. He raised the possibility of a one-day special session that he said he and House Speaker Mike Bush could call. It wouldn't have to be called by the governor. One-day special session to deal with just those two issues. Now, I should say, even Miller said it was used the adjective remote when he was discussing this. Andy, is this going to happen?
No, this is not going to happen because there is no urgent, pressing reason to do it.
You don't consider cutting people's taxes urgent and pressing?
It's something that can be done the next time they come. You know, if it's really a one day thing, they can pass it on the first day of the regular session next year and still have it be in effect for people's tax bills. But I think there's a lot more discussion that needs to go on before everyone's on the same page with these pieces of legislation. Anyway, it's not like we're in a situation where they failed to pass a budget, failed to pass an effective budget, as was the case a few years ago, or it's not something that needs to be put on the ballot for this fall, as was the case with the gambling special session. It's not the case that the state's budget is way out of whack, as was the case in the 2007 special session, or not that doctors' medical malpractice rates are about to go through the roof, as happened in the 2004 special session. You know, there's nothing so urgent that it has to be done now. You know, some states do special sessions willy-nilly. Maryland does not.
There's another point that bears on why there will not be a special session. If they have a special session after the governor has vetoed bills, the first order of business has to be the vetoed bills. And I'm not sure either presiding officer wants to go through what could be a long discussion of the vetoed bills and efforts to override ones that Democrats want to go into effect. So I doubt that you would have a special session.
If, in fact, the governor vetoes anything.
I wanted to pick up on that because Governor Hogan just let about two dozen bills that he didn't particularly like. He said they weren't worth vetoing.
Right, but they were passed early in the session to put the pressure on the governor to either sign or veto the bill so the vetoes could be overridden while the session was still ongoing.
Right. And for the most part, he didn't
take... It's different now. You have a whole slew of hundreds of bills that now end up on the governor's desk, some of which he may find objectionable and he may veto, in which case you may have another shootout at the OK Corral.
And that's what I'm trying to home in on here. What do you think has landed on the governor's desk or will that is veto bait?
Specifically, we're hearing that the governor may have some reservations about the law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights reform. Police unions have objected to this, and he hasn't said whether he will sign or not sign it. So that's certainly one. I wouldn't call it veto bait, not in the sense that Democrats have been known when there's a Republican governor to pass legislation specifically to get him to veto it. I don't think that's what was behind this particular bill, but it is something we know the governor is thinking about that would, I think, be definitely subject of an override fight if he were to veto it.
Anything else that we should be watching for whether or not the governor vetoes? Well,
we really don't know at this point. Lawyers for the governor are going to have to go over all of these bills with a fine-tooth comb just to make sure there isn't something hidden in them that a conservative Republican governor might object to. There may be any number of vetoes on bills that we don't even suspect would be controversial.
Now, I suspect some Democrats, if they're Democratic legislators, if they are awake at noon to be listening to the radio, would say, well, if the governor had sent his cabinet secretaries and other officials to our hearings, where they so often were missing, the Democrats said, they'd know what's in these bills.
Well, that's true. That's true. Larry Hogan clearly favors politics over policy. His legislative agenda was not chock full of policy issues that might be termed earth-shattering. He's the opposite of Martin O'Malley. He doesn't want to make waves. Martin O'Malley was a reform governor. Larry Hogan is sort of a status quo governor. His main concerns are reducing the size of the budget, if he can, and cutting taxes. And he thinks that's good enough to get him reelected. He remains a very popular figure among voters. And
70% approval?
Yeah, whatever it is. I mean, that figure is going to go up and down, and we're not going to know till the actual election campaign in 2 years whether the polls today mean anything or not. But
he cites it a lot, though. I mean, he uses that as...
Yes, he uses it as a political tool. Mm-hmm. And
but not so much as political capital to spend on particular initiatives. You get the Democrats and the governor arguing a lot. There's a lot of, you played some clips of it at the top of the show, of the Democrats and the governor sniping back and forth at each other yesterday, with each accusing the other one of being the partisan bully and suggesting the other side is bringing us into Washington-style gridlock and all of that. But, you know, I don't see how this is working out badly for either side. Governor Hogan, as Barry said, is not a legislatively oriented governor. You know, somebody like Martin O'Malley was very engaged in introducing legislation, marshaling support, getting it passed, which is not, you know, which is one model of governor. Larry Hogan is a different model of governor who is basically seemingly willing to sit back and let the legislature be the chief policy arm of the government. And he will veto some things. He'll sign some things. He'll let some things go into law. He's focused on the budget, on running the agencies. That's working out great for him. And the legislature is largely able to develop its own agenda, you know, say with the Baltimore package or law enforcement Bill of Rights reforms or, any number of other initiatives they put forward this year. So far as I can tell, it's working out great for both sides.
Well, it's interesting that the comparison between O'Malley and Hogan really boils down to which one was the lucky Irishman. Because Martin O'Malley had no luck at all while he was governor, because he had to experience the Great Recession. And that dragged on throughout his 8 years in office, which meant every year there was a budget crisis. And sometimes he had to raise taxes in order to balance the budget and also achieve some of his goals. Larry Hogan comes into office, and he gets all the luck because the recession is drawing to a close. Revenues are on the upswing for the state of Maryland. So he doesn't have any budget problems. He can basically sit back, fund everything in the budget without any qualms, and then suggest tax cuts. So it's the best of all worlds for Larry Hogan. He does have luck on his side.
That's political commentator Barry Raskovar here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green. We're looking back at the General Assembly session, which ended at midnight last night. And you can be part of this conversation. What passed or failed to pass in the legislature that you were keeping an eye on? What kind of a session do you think it was? A success for the citizens of Maryland as well as the legislators and the governor? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Barry, I recall, and if I'm crediting you with something somebody else wrote, I'm sure you'll tell me, but I think you were the one who wrote that Governor Hogan might be creating a monster if the General Assembly gets used to setting the policy. I think the point you were making, Andy, that under Martin O'Malley, O'Malley tended to make the policy proposals and the legislature acted on them or didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's changing.
Yes, it is. Maryland's constitution and just tradition in Maryland is that the governor leads and the legislature follows. It's the governor who sets the agenda for the 90-day legislative session. That's the way it's always been. This time, though, it was a very slim agenda that Hogan put out, and much of it was highly partisan Republican ideology. And, of course, the Democratic leadership in the legislature wasn't going to go along in that direction. So what they did, and it's the first time I've seen that in my memory, is the legislative leadership put together a package of bills to come to the aid of Baltimore City. It was an extensive...
Largely driven by Mike Bush, and then Mike Miller signed on.
Yes, and we've never seen a package of bills like this that was created by the legislature with no input from the governor, was passed with virtually no input from the governor, and that tried to tie the governor's hands in a number of respects. I think this is going to be repeated in the next session or two, with legislative leaders drawing together, realizing that they have a very partisan governor that they're dealing with, and they may have to see if they can maintain the upper hand. So we saw it this session with the aid package for Baltimore City.
And while we're talking about that, I'd like to play a clip of Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake at a press conference yesterday.
There are several ways that the Hogan administration has fallen flat when it comes to supporting Baltimore City. When it comes to transportation, we have been abandoned. I have heard nothing but frustration from residents and community members who attend the transportation meetings talking about this colorful, B-Link. I would consider an embarrassment when you have a multi-billion dollar project that can transform lives and our keep Maryland competitive, that it's replaced with a colorful bus line.
The multi-billion dollar project she's referring to there, of course, is mm-hmm. the red line, the subway line that Governor Hogan decided not to go forward with. Governor Hogan had a press conference later in the day where he pointed out that the city of Baltimore and Prince George's County will be getting the bulk of state funds, and he would prefer that they just each said thank you as opposed to...
Yeah, well, this is, you know, any governor could say that in any given year. The bulk of the aid goes to...
Because most of it is means tested.
The largest and neediest jurisdictions. Mm-hmm.
Much like any governor any year can say he's spending a record amount on education.
Exactly.
It's true every year.
Yeah, right. But what does this tell us about going forward? I mean, he's already signed this package, right? Or is this one of the things
he let it go into law without his signature? Yeah, so
does he get any credit for that?
No, probably not, but he doesn't need credit for that. It's not something that is tremendously important to him or his base. But it is more important for him to not look like he's standing in the way of it. To have vetoed it would have been problematic for him. To let it go into law without his signature is probably the smart move for him politically. And you look at some other things that came up. You know, obviously, the red line, he's going to get blamed for, justifiably, in my view, by a lot of people in the Baltimore region, no matter what. There's really nothing he can do about that. However, there are other things. You know, for example, this year when we came in to the session and he introduced his initial budget, it was missing funds for this demolition program for Baltimore that he had promised. It was missing operating funds for Prince George's Hospital to assist it during its transition to a hopefully financially viable model. He had put in money to help some rural counties deal with enrollment drops in their schools, but did not put in such money for Baltimore City schools. But by the end of the session, demolition money was in, Prince George's Hospital money was in, Baltimore City school aid was in. So, you know...
Did he extract any concessions by waiting to put that money into his budget?
Not to speak of, no. No, with the demolition money, there was a memorandum of understanding that the state and the city had to work out, and they did, and then that was accomplished. And with the others, you know, I think he just made problems go away, basically.
Well, you know, we're never going to know if by omitting these items from his budget initially, he was trying to extract concessions on those or other issues, because the legislature forced his hand. They wrote into these laws that were passed, the Baltimore City aid package, mandates. You have to spend this money, Governor, on vacant housing. and demolition. You know, you have to do this, you have to do that. That's what Hogan objected to, the new mandates. I mean, one of the bills that he refused to sign, which surprised me, was the University of Maryland partnership bill between the College Park campus and the professional schools campus in Baltimore. This is a bill that has huge economic development implications for the future. You would think a Republican governor would just embrace this and hold it close to his chest and take credit for it. But there are a couple of small little mandates in there, $3 million for a program in Baltimore to help commercialize some of the discoveries, and another, I think it's $12 or $15 million over 5 years for the College Park campus to do much the same thing. But this is to create new companies in Maryland. And again, you'd think the governor would just jump into this with both feet. But that's not Hogan's style. And throughout the session, he continually refused to get involved in what the legislature was up to and just sat on the sidelines and shouted criticisms rather than trying to go on the field with the players and try to, you know, try to score a touchdown together.
This thing about mandates is a recurring theme of this session. I mean, he really has been quite opposed, and that was why he vetoed the transportation bill that is going to require him to require a scoring system.
That one's a little bit different
transportation projects.
From the mandated spending question. So what this does is it sets up a system where a set of criteria will be established for transportation projects so that they get scored on a variety of factors, you know, economic development potential, environmental impacts, transit friendliness, you know, all sorts of different metrics. And so the idea is that all of these proposed transportation projects would get a numerical score. And so you will see whether something that's getting scored highly is being passed over for something that scores low but happens to be in a jurisdiction that the governor wants to get support from, you know, this sort of thing. And it would not, in fact, prohibit the governor from advancing a lower scoring project. It would just require him to basically explain why he's doing it. We at the Sun editorial board were not particularly impressed with this legislation as either being a great thing or a terrible thing. It seems like it's not really going to accomplish much of anything, and we're a little perplexed as to why the two sides have fought so vehemently over it.
This I think would qualify as veto bait, would it not?
Yeah, it did. Although, frankly, it doesn't impede the governor from doing what the governor needs to do anyway. But he did object mightily, sort of under the rubric of these are things the legislature is trying to do to curtail the governor's powers. And so there were a number of issues like that came up during the session. For example, the legislature wanted to provide for Senate confirmation for the superintendent of Maryland schools. We're right now searching for a new superintendent. They wanted to essentially mandate an accelerated process and give the Senate a bite of the apple there to try to
have a say in it. Who's finally approved.
And so that that was a bad idea that was killed. A similar fight played out a little bit in regard to the Baltimore City Liquor Board. There was community objection to Governor Hogan's appointees to the board, and so they were rejected by the Senate. The Senate tried to force the governor to come up with new names that they would agree to before the end of the session. He didn't want to do that, and so instead they have decided to give the mayor and city council the ability to name the people on the liquor board, though again, giving the Senate confirmation powers.
Yeah. I'm out of it.
Yeah. But, in the end, this is something that should be a local function anyway.
Quick thought, we need to take a break.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk about an upcoming issue that's going to be a battle between the governor and the legislature.
I think I know what that is, but we will talk about it when we get back. We're going to take a short break here. We're going to talk to some callers, too, when we get back. More from Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green and Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog. Join the conversation by sending us an email, midday@wypr.org, or phone us, 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the ins and outs of this year's General Assembly session. It ended at midnight. I'm speaking with Andy Green, Baltimore Sun opinion editor, and Barry Raskovar of the Political Maryland blog, and taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. So, Barry, what is it that is issue that we haven't talked about that we need to?
Yes, I think you can look in the future to a battle between the governor and the legislature over some of the governor's appointments. In the past, the legislature has been very lenient and has not made much scrutiny of appointments by the governor. Only on rare occasions would they raise an objection, and almost never would they reject a nomination. But because of the controversies this year over some of the nominations that the governor has submitted, I think in the next 2 years, you're going to see the Democratic legislature making sure that they give very close scrutiny to many of Hogan's appointments, especially for local school boards, where, you know, there already are some controversies brewing that perhaps some of the nominees favor charter schools, have a more conservative attitude toward public schools. And I think this could be a hot-button issue going forward.
Did we see the same thing during the last Republican administration, the Ehrlich administration?
Not to the same extent. The Democratic legislature did famously reject one of his cabinet nominees, Lynn Buell, who was the nominee for Environment Secretary. But by and large, they let others through. You know, I don't recall there having been someone else they rejected. Whereas this year, we saw the legislature reject four different Hogan appointees, three nominees for the City Liquor Board, and one nominee for the Handgun Permit Review Panel.
And there was quite a bit of scrutiny of somebody for the Public Service Commission.
Yes, and quite a bit of scrutiny for the Public Service Commission. This was a former member of the Hogan administration who has been serving on the PSC while waiting for confirmation, and there was controversy about emails he had sent back and forth giving his former administration mates heads up about various things going on at the PSC. But the legislature did eventually allow him to go through after he made appropriate mea culpas. But these other four were pretty notable, particularly because they are not the kinds of high-profile things you would typically have seen fights over. You know, the Handgun Permit Review Board, I would challenge the listeners how many of them were aware of its existence until this became an issue.
Although that was a campaign issue, and people who expected the Republican running for governor would want to undermine the gun control law, he was asked whether he would enforce it, and basically
he
said
he didn't really
would.
Answer much.
You know, here's the conundrum that Hogan faces. When he was elected, one of the reasons he's elected governor is that he avoided the hot-button social issues that conservative Republicans care dearly about. Because he recognized that Maryland was a much more liberal state than most of the other states in the nation that elect Republicans, so he's tried to avoid those hot button issues. If he starts appointing people to, say, the Handgun Permit Review Board, who allow more guns to be carried, then all of a sudden he's creating a controversy he tried to avoid when he was running the first time for governor. So the legislature may have done him a favor by knocking this guy off the permit review board.
Jim is calling us from Severna Park. Jim, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question is a procedural rather than a substantive question, and it has to do with the difference between calendar and legislative days.
Oh, boy.
For example, yesterday, even though there was one calendar day, there were three legislative days. And the question is, could you explain that and perhaps explain whether you think it's good or bad? For example, the Constitution mandates that bills have to be read three times, and by having three legislative days in one day, they bypass that requirement, and so they can have the bill read the three times and pass it. Is that good or bad for Maryland, that
Jim,
you can bypass the Constitution?
Jim, you're really paying close attention. Let me see whether Andy or Barry can address it. Thanks for the call.
Well, I think it happens in almost every legislature that they have to find mechanisms to advance bills more quickly as time starts to run out. It's it just helps the process. If you didn't have that, if you were stuck with just calendar days, by the time you got to the 90th or the 89th or the 80th day, you might be up the creek without a paddle. So this gives them another
tool.
But
that doesn't mean it's constitutional. I mean, how many years ago was it that they stopped actually stopping the clocks? Back when I covered the legislature all those decades ago, they used to stop the hands of the clock when they still had work they wanted to get done. And so midnight on the clock in the chamber wouldn't come along until 3 a.m. or something like that. That went to court, and the court said, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certainly times where it's just used for expediency, but there are also times when, you know, issues break toward the end of a legislative session and suddenly you realize, oh, gosh, we need to address this issue that we did not realize. So there are tricks of art like that. You know, I don't know whether I would say it's a good thing or a bad thing so much as it is a semi-necessary thing.
I cut you off, Barry. You were saying it is constitutional.
Well, I believe it is constitutional. And if it, let's just assume it's not constitutional, what you would end up forcing is overtime work by the legislature, in which the in which both chambers would extend the session from 90 days in order to get emergency legislation through. So this is just a device to keep the trains running on time. When you go down and you follow the legislature on a daily basis, you realize this is not an easy task. There's 188 people down there, and they're all pulling in different directions. So you have to come up with some mechanisms to make it all work within a 90-day time frame. If this were a year-round session, you wouldn't have to do it.
And I would also point out that in a lot of other states, you know, New York, Illinois, places like that, you will see legislatures routinely going months and months over time in consideration of budget and other matters. And that does not happen here. So I think that's probably a good thing in the end that we're able to manage the time effectively.
Barry, a few minutes ago when you said there was an issue that was going to be a point of great contention between the governor and the legislature that you thought we needed to address, I thought you were going to raise redistricting, redrawing congressional boundaries in a less gerrymandered way. Andy Green, that was one of the governor's top priorities,
yes.
At least he said it was. His proposal had the support of liberal special interest groups, including the League of Women Voters. But, I mean, this was always a long shot in a legislature controlled by Democrats.
Mike Miller said flat out, ain't going to happen. Some lawmakers have floated this idea that we do a mutual assistance pact with Virginia where we enact some kind of nonpartisan commission if they do.
The point of that would be that in redrawing congressional lines, if the
Democrats
would if there would be lines drawn in Maryland that would be less favorable to Democrats electing Democratic people to Congress,
right.
the new way of drawing lines in Virginia would presumably put fewer Republicans at an advantage.
Right. Obviously not a terribly easy to work kind of compromise. Ultimately, where I see this playing out is that Governor Hogan will introduce some variation of this every year. The Democrats will not give it the time of day every year. And then Governor Hogan will hammer them with this when he runs for re-election every single day, as it is perhaps the only issue in Maryland that is more popular with voters than he is.
Now, there are some things the legislature could do or the governor could do. If the governor wanted to be practical and pragmatic about this, he could tomorrow create such a nonpartisan redistricting commission to advise the governor as to how to draw the next congressional boundary lines. And he could then announce that he would abide by their decisions and would not interfere in the lines they drew. But he's not going to do that because, as Andy described, there's a much more politically effective way to hammer the Democrats. And at the same time, you're really not making any progress on solving the gerrymandering situation.
And also, this does not come up as a practical issue until sometime in the next governor's term. So this whole debate will look very different if we have a second term Governor Hogan set to be the prime mover in drawing the lines, that might focus the legislature's attention on this issue in a way that it is not now.
Right, because right now they are operating on the assumption that he'll be a one-term governor?
Well, or at least the hope. They haven't given up hope of that, I suppose.
Yes, but remember, this is not till after the 2020 census. So it means the 2021 General Assembly session is when you're going to have the next redistricting battle.
A couple of things. First of all, Barry, did you just say that the governor could set up his own commission?
Sure, tomorrow. You can do it today.
Okay. And that strikes me as a pretty politically powerful. I mean, if Andy's right that this is that drawing less gerrymandered districts is a really popular idea, if he actually went through that process and created a map and said, look, this is the kinds of compact, contiguous districts.
Sheila, he could turn to the League of Women Voters and ask them to draw a nonpartisan congressional redistricting map. And he said, I'll go with whatever you come up with.
Right.
But
again,
you
however,
said that's
this is
less
not
politically effective. I would think that would be a huge.
The legislature could do the same thing, by the way. Say this is going to be our advisory group on redistricting.
So you could have dueling advisory groups.
But again, none of this can happen until after the next census anyway. So it's not like something Hogan could effectively do tomorrow because, you know, the Constitution says we redraw these lines after the census, and the census is
this is an issue. It's sort of much ado about nothing, just like the transportation veto bill
the
was
scoring,
concerned.
Scoring the projects.
Yes, it really doesn't amount to much at the moment. And you wonder why there's so much fighting over it.
Because anytime you're talking about who gets elected, that's something politicians fight over. and we're talking primarily about congressional boundaries. There's not the same attention or the same concern about drawing the boundaries of the legislative
Governor
districts.
Governor Hogan's reform proposal does include legislative districts as well, but the state constitution does include some additional requirements that legislative districts be compact and contiguous and respect boundaries in as much as possible. So those are generally agreed to be not as egregiously awful as the congressional districts are.
We're down to a minute and a half or so. So I'd just like a closing thought from each of you about what you think citizens got or didn't get out of this session.
I think citizens got a pretty decent session. You know, say the NOAA's law, the interlocks for first-time drunk drivers, that's a huge advance. It's been bottled up forever. The criminal justice reinvestment, that's a big deal. Law enforcement officer Bill of Rights, important issue. Aid for Baltimore, that's certainly needed and timely. You know, all in all, I thought it was a pretty good session, the sniping and bickering aside.
Yeah, I think the sentencing and parole reforms are major, major pieces of legislation. It's going to take a number of years before we tinker. You're going to have to tinker with it some more to get it right. But I think this is a huge step in the right direction toward treatment instead of incarceration for minor offenders. I think the city aid package is one of many aid packages that are going to go going forward. And the University of Maryland partnership, I just think, could be huge as far as economic development with new technologies in Baltimore and in Maryland.
Lots for us to keep an eye on how it works out. Thank you both.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Barry Rascavar of the Political Maryland blog, thank you. And Andy Green, Baltimore Sun opinion editor. I'm grateful to you both. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. The Baltimore-based nonprofit Thread supports inner-city students from middle school through college with incredible results. What's their secret? That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.